Hello and welcome to episode 8 of NLDR, the Narrative Lectionary Podcast for People on the Go. My name is Dr. Amy Robertson, and I'm here each and every week with my friend and colleague, Dr. Robert Williamson, to talk about how this week's biblical text lives in our minds and in our hearts. This week we find ourselves in 1 Kings, where the United Monarchy is already falling apart only 2 generations after King David. Bobby and I talk about the frequently destructive nature of political power, the importance of individual accountability within a covenanted community, and, you guessed it, the proverbial thickness of our father's loins. Thanks for being with us. Hello, Bobby.
Hi, Amy. How are you this week?
I am doing well. How are you doing?
I'm doing really well.
I am excited to read another very exciting chapter in the drama of the kings of Israel.
Yes, indeed. This one got some action packed in here.
We got some drama, yes. Yeah. When last we spoke, we had just sort of met King David, and King David was becoming king over both the northern kingdom, which is referred to as Israel when they're separated, and the southern kingdom of Judah. And I know we pointed out some specific things that he did to try to help bring the north and the south together. He picked a capital area, that Jerusalem, that had just been acquired. And so it wasn't sort of a clearly northern or southern territory. And he moved the religious center of the people to the political capital. So that was sort of another way to try to get everyone together on the same page under his kingship.
Right.
So we need a catch up from there to where we are.
So after David's rule, then his son Solomon becomes the king who ultimately builds the temple. So David had wanted to build a temple for God in Jerusalem in 2 Samuel chapter 7. But God says, no, you're not going to build me a house. Your son Solomon's going to do that. So in 1 Kings 7 and 8, Solomon constructs and dedicates a temple. So now we've got kind of stepping up this idea that you were talking about, where David had brought the ark to Jerusalem. Now God actually lives in Jerusalem, and the king has built that house, is in charge of it. So there's a closer tie that Solomon is making to God, undergirding his power and authority. Solomon's remembered as a wise and good king, and Israel is remembered as prosperous during that time. We do get a little notice in 1 Kings chapter 5, which is going to be important to us later, that King Solomon forced people into labor for him. So in 1 Kings 5:13, King Solomon conscripted forced labor out of all Israel, 30,000 men. So he's a pretty harsh taskmaster who works the people hard to gain his own wealth and power. The other thing that's important about Solomon as we lead into this text is that in 1 Kings chapter 11, the text remembers that when Solomon got older, he married a lot of women, 700 princesses and 300 secondary wives is what the text says. And a lot of these women were foreigners, and the Hebrew Bible is nervous about foreign women because they will lead the king astray from following God properly. And that's what is remembered about Solomon, that he starts to build idolatrous shrines to other gods and things like that. So in 1 Kings 11, God says, I'm going to punish you by taking away most of your kingdom, but I'm not going to do it in your time. I'm going to do it in your son's time, because I made a promise to your father David that I wouldn't take the kingdom from you. So when we enter into 1 Kings chapter 12, we're looking at Solomon has died. There is this promise or curse, I guess, that God has made that the kingdom's going to be divided. And that's the backdrop for this text that we are about to read.
That brings us to 1 Kings chapter 12, which is where the narrative lectionary has us this week. So I will just go ahead and start reading. Solomon's son's name is Rehoboam. Rehoboam went to Shechem, for all Israel had come to Shechem to acclaim him as king. Jeroboam, son of Nebat, learned of it while he was still in Egypt, for Jeroboam had fled from King Solomon and had settled in Egypt. They sent for him, and Jeroboam and all the assembly of Israel came and spoke to Rehoboam as follows. Your father made our yoke heavy. Now lighten the harsh labor and the heavy yoke which your father laid on us, and we will serve you. He answered them, go away for 3 days and then come back to me. So the people went away. Let's stop there for a minute. So Shechem is a city, a major city that is north of Jerusalem. I guess I would say sort of in the heart of the northern tribes that, you know, that we would refer to as Israel as opposed to Judah. The mention of Jeroboam here, when the word comes to Solomon that the kingdom will be taken from his son, it says it will be given to his servant.
Right, just right before this in 1 Kings 11, I think you were referring to Jeroboam is working for Solomon. He's one of Solomon's, part of Solomon's cabinet, I guess. And then the prophet Ahijah or Ahijah shows up and says to Jeroboam, hey, God's going to give you part of the kingdom. And he tears up part of Jeroboam's robe and gives him 10 pieces and keeps one and says, God's going to give you the 10 tribes. So Jeroboam has known in the previous chapter that he's going to receive part of the kingdom, which kind of is an interesting backdrop for this story. But he knows that it's not his time in the time of Solomon, so he flees away into Egypt, and then he comes back here in 1 Kings 12. It's interesting, though, in this text that Jeroboam doesn't come back trying to take the kingdom, even though he knows that Ahijah has told him that God's going to give it to him. Jeroboam comes back and says, you're the king. Your dad, Solomon, worked us too hard. But if you will ease up on us a little bit, we'll be loyal to you. So Jeroboam actually comes back as a loyal subject of King Solomon.
In terms of the purpose of the gathering, it seems as though the kinghood should automatically pass from Solomon to Rehoboam. But right. There's this gathering of all of Israel to have some kind of ceremonial affirmation.
Right.
But you're right. Jeroboam doesn't come and say, ten of the tribes have been given to me. He says, you need to chill out.
Right. It seems like they've gathered to acclaim Rehoboam as the king. That's the plan. That's the way succession works. Jeroboam's planning to go along with it. But he says this conscripted labor thing is too much for us. So just ease up and we'll go along with your rule. Yeah.
So then Rehoboam says, go away for 3 days. Let me sort of think about this and then come back to me.
Right.
And so the people do. So then picking up then in verse 6, King Rehoboam. So now he's become King Rehoboam in the text. King Rehoboam took counsel with the elders who had served his father Solomon during his lifetime. He said, what answer do you advise me to give this people? They answered him, if you will be a servant to those people today and serve them, and if you respond to them with kind words, they will be your servants again. But he ignored the advice that the elders gave him and took counsel with the young men who had grown up with him and were serving him. What, he asked, do you advise that we reply to the people who said to me, lighten the yoke that your father placed upon us? And the young men who had grown up with him answered, speak thus to the people who said to you, your father made our yoke heavy, now you make it lighter for us. Say to them, my little finger is thicker than my father's loins.
Oh, yeah.
That is just, okay, we'll get back to that in a minute.
Yes.
My father imposed a heavy yoke on you, and I will add to your yoke. My father flogged you with whips, but I will flog you with scorpions. I was just telling Bobby that for the past several days, anyone who has come into my home, I had said, come, sit, let me read you a line of the Bible and we will pray on it together. And I read them the line. My little finger is thicker than my father's loins. And they were surprised to know that that was in the biblical text. Here it is.
The Bible says things sometimes.
The Bible says many things. So, I mean, this in some ways is just this like classic scene of Rehoboam asking the people who are professional advisors who advised his father. And they said, they're making a reasonable request. They'll be loyal to you if you will be a servant to them. You know, if you will sort of lower your burden on them. But then he goes and asks his like buddies that he like played stickball with out in the street. And they had this other idea.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of an interesting dynamic that's going on here. There's a generational thing that's happening between the older advisors and the younger advisors. The translation there was the young men who grew up with him. The Hebrew there is gadlu, so it can mean to grow up, but it could also mean to become great with him or become powerful with him. So it's sort of this sense of like people who are newly in positions of power versus people who have been there a while. And these more experienced servants give him this very, what seemingly sage advice, give a little and you'll have an eternal dynasty. And the whippersnappers say, you go and show them who's boss, right? If they thought your father Solomon was bad, like you show them you can be even worse.
No, I like the idea of thinking of it too as sort of people who are newer to power or newer to leadership. I mean, it is certainly an understanding of what power looks like, of what the power dynamic between a king and the king's people might look like. But it's sort of so over the top in this text that it's laughable. I mean, I whip you with scorpions, really?
Yeah, and no one's quite sure what that means exactly. Some people have suggested that a scorpion is a type of whip. Some people have suggested that it's like a bramble. I don't imagine it's like little actual like scorpions.
That would be very challenging.
Yeah, like tying them together. but yeah, it's going to hurt is the point. Like you thought that whip hurt bad. Like this one's going to hurt you really bad. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that seems to be happening in this text is the dynasty is getting used to power. So when David became the king, I mean, David had his problems for sure, but David had to struggle for his kingdom. He didn't take things for granted. We talked last week about how David realized he was taking God a little for granted and tried to shape up a little bit and be more careful with God's holiness. Mm-hmm. Then you have Solomon who escalates to conscripted labor. Now you have Rehoboam who wants to escalate it even further. Mm-hmm. So you've got this sense that the longer people stay in power, the more they kind of become invested more in preserving and increasing their own power than they do in taking care of the people the way the people are supposed to be cared for.
Right, and sort of the trappings of that power. You know, with Solomon, it was sort of all these riches and all these women. And I would imagine that some of the conscripted labor was just sort of a function of his desire for this, you know, well-built up sort of palatial presence that he wanted to have. Whereas Rehoboam, it seems like, is just sort of forgot about all the foundations and is just focusing on the trappings. And it has just become sort of like a cruelty dynamic, really.
Yeah, and there's no purpose behind it. I think you're right about that. It's so interesting to me, back to this thing about my little finger being thicker than my father's loins. Like, I mean, we had that same rhetoric in the 2016 election. Remember all that? And like, Trump's hands are small, therefore other parts of him must be small. And he's like, no, I assure you, there's no problems down there. I mean, it's just interesting. Like, this has been 3,000 years and people are still sort of arguing about loin size and power. And like, this just goes straight to it. Like, there's a critique here of male masculine power dynamics, I think.
Okay, so what we just read is the advice that Rehoboam has received. He hasn't done this yet. So picking up in verse 12, Jeroboam and all the people came to Rehoboam on the third day, since the king had told them, come back on the third day. The king answered the people harshly, ignoring the advice that the elders had given him. He spoke to them in accordance with the advice of the young men and said, my father made your yoke heavy, but I will add to your yoke. My father flogged you with whips, but I will flog you with scorpions. The king did not listen to the people, for the Lord had brought it about in order to fulfill the promise that the Lord had made through Ahijah the Shilonite to Jeroboam, son of Nebat. So here's where we have Rehoboam actually, you know, he didn't say anything about his father's loins, but he did tell the people that he was going to be harsher on them than his father was. Does the NRSV have verse 15 in parentheses?
It does not.
So verse 15 is after Rehoboam has spoken to the people. There's like the close quotes. And then it's sort of this explanatory note. That's when it says the king did not listen to the people. And it tells you that the reason is that it has to fulfill the promise that the Lord had made in the previous chapter.
Right. So it's really an aside to the reader that the narrator has made. In case you didn't catch the significance of what Rehoboam just said, here's what it is.
Right.
Yeah.
This text definitely seems to have an angle. The narrator has a way that they want you to understand whatever the historical happenings were, and everything is told very clearly through that lens.
It seems to me like this is a pro-David text, which is yet critical of the Davidic dynasty. It wants to say that David was a great king. God made a promise to David that God keeps, but the kings in David's line tend to be so unfaithful to God that God has to do something. And so Rehoboam then becomes this power-hungry guy as a way of justifying why did David's kingdom not stay united? Well, it's not because God was unfaithful. It's because Solomon and Rehoboam were bad kings.
Right, and it just became untenable.
And that trend continues on, right? The first and second kings think all the kings of Israel are terrible and all the kings of Judah are terrible except for David, Hezekiah, and Josiah. So it is generally pretty negative about the kings themselves, but positive about the Davidic kingship. And I think you start to see that happening in this text.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And I think that's also where we get, you know, later in later texts, we'll be looking at some of this longing for, you know, an anointed one who can come and sort of get them out of the terrible situation that they're in.
Right. That verse that you pointed out as a parenthetical, the king didn't listen to the people because it was brought about by the Lord that he might fulfill his word. So there is a complex attribution there that the reason Rehoboam is making bad decisions is because God has made a prophecy to Jeroboam through the prophet Ahijah in the previous chapter that God is now keeping by Rehoboam being an idiot.
It's like the idea of like God hardening the heart of Pharaoh or something like that.
Exactly. That's a perfect analogy. So God is sometimes behind making people make really terrible decisions to keep the prophecies unfolding the way that they're supposed to unfold. I don't really know what to do with that. Like, that line troubles me, but it makes the thing interesting. Rehoboam's not just a bad king of his own accord, but he's a bad king because God needs him to be a bad king. So God can do this thing to Solomon that God said God would do.
No, you're right. And in some ways, it's really good that that aside is there because, you know, reading up to that point, it's easy to just attribute like, well, Rehoboam was a psycho, but he also is a pawn.
I think about that sometimes when people talk about how the ruling authorities are in power because God wants them to be in power. And the biblical text affirms that idea for the most part, but it's not always saying that by way of saying, and therefore the ruling authority is a good authority. It's just saying God has a purpose for whoever is in power to be in power. So God needs Rehoboam to be in power so that God can take part of the kingdom away. And God needs Jeroboam to be in power, even though Jeroboam's going to turn around in just a second and become a screw-up
Oh my
tip.
Gosh, yeah, he sure is. All right, moving right along. We are up to verse 16 here. When all Israel saw that the king had not listened to them, the people answered the king, "We have no portion in David, no share in Jesse's son. To your tents, O Israel. Now look to your own house, O David." So the Israelites returned to their homes. But Rehoboam continued to reign over the Israelites who lived in the towns of Judah. You know, this is the response of the northern tribes is like, are you kidding? Like, no, they left. They just, you know, they took their cookies and went home.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And it's interesting. I mean, 10 tribes go with Jeroboam, which means Rehoboam was never in a position of strength, but Rehoboam, not understanding his position, has flexed his muscles, and Jeroboam and the Israelites have said, yeah, we don't need to deal with this.
Right. So then we have a short section here in the middle that is not included in the narrative lectionary, but we will include it here just to give us, to fill in some context. So beginning in verse 18, King Rehoboam sent Adoram, who was in charge of the forced labor, but all Israel pelted him to death with stones. Thereupon, King Rehoboam hurriedly mounted his chariot and fled to Jerusalem. Thus Israel revolted against the house of David, as is still the case. When all Israel heard that Jeroboam had returned, they sent messengers and summoned him to the assembly and made him king over all Israel. Only the tribe of Judah remained loyal to the house of David. Okay, so what has happened here is Rehoboam makes a pretty small attempt to get the northern tribes in line. Like, he sends one guy who gets pelted.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, they throw rocks at him, and then he's like, oh, never mind. And he goes back to Jerusalem.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Rehoboam talks big talk, but he has no idea how to be a strong arm.
He has no idea what he's doing. And then in the next part, it says that all Israel heard that Jeroboam had returned and made him king over all Israel. And we need to point out here, at least I think, when they say all Israel, they mean the northern tribes.
That's right. Yeah. So from here on, for the rest of 1 and 2 Kings, the term Israel really does refer to the geographic region, basically north of Jerusalem.
And Rehoboam still has control over Judah.
That's right.
Verse 21. On his return to Jerusalem, Rehoboam mustered all the house of Judah and the tribe of Benjamin, 180,000 picked warriors, to fight against the house of Israel in order to restore the kingship to Rehoboam, son of Solomon. But the word of God came to Shemaiah, the man of God. Say to King Rehoboam, son of Solomon of Judah, and to all the house of Judah and Benjamin and the rest of the people, thus said the Lord, you shall not set out to make war upon your kinsmen, the Israelites. Let every man return to his home, for this thing has been brought about by me. They heeded the word of the Lord and turned back in accordance with the word of the Lord. So once again here, you see a somewhat half-hearted effort to bring the kingdom back into a united monarchy. But when a word comes through a prophet that God had brought about this thing and they should not wage war, they stop.
And it's interesting. You don't get any...
We don't get any like interior access to Rehoboam. We have no idea what he's thinking or what his logic is or why he does this or doesn't do this.
And the prophet speaks to Rehoboam and also to the people at the same time. And then the people go home. So you don't really know if the people abandoned Rehoboam or if Rehoboam sent them home.
Right.
But in one way or another, the people have recognized at this point that this splitting of North and South, Israel and Judah, is God's will, and they're not going to fight against it anymore.
Yes, although what happens next, I don't think was part of the plan.
No.
So in verse 25, Jeroboam fortified Shechem in the hill country of Ephraim and resided there. He moved out from there and fortified Penuel. Jeroboam said to himself, now the kingdom may well return to the house of David. If these people still go up to offer sacrifices at the house of the Lord in Jerusalem, the heart of these people will turn back to their master, King Rehoboam of Judah. They will kill me and go back to King Rehoboam of Judah. I think that's a really interesting worry and probably a valid one. I mean, we talked about how powerful it was for David to have moved the cult center to Jerusalem. And now Jeroboam is basically saying, I can have power over the northern tribes, but if they still need to make pilgrimages to Jerusalem every time they need to offer a sacrifice, which is several times a year, their heart will always be attached to the Davidic king.
That's exactly right. And I mean, Jeroboam's in a really tough position here, as you're describing. He's got his kingdom, but the worship center is in the capital of the competing kingdom that his rival Rehoboam is in charge of. So what are you to do? I mean, in my mind, if you're just thinking as a strategic political thinker, he does exactly what he should have done.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the places he fortifies, Shechem and Penuel, you remember Penuel is the place where Jacob wrestles with the angel that we talked about in Genesis 32. In a minute, he's going to build a shrine at Bethel, which is the place where Jacob saw the vision of the angels going up and down the ladder.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like, I mean,
they're
very
not random
clear.
Places. Like, these are places that have real resonance.
Right. That's exactly right. So they're not random places, and it's not a random God. So he's doing the best that he can do, but there is this command that God should only be worshipped now in Jerusalem, and that's going to come back to bite him here in this next little section.
Well, yes, and I agree with you that what he's done in these past three verses has logic to it that makes sense, and it all seems reasonable. But then, in verse 28, so the king took counsel and made two golden calves.
Ooh.
Really, Jeroboam? Golden calves?
Yeah.
I mean, come on. Like, it's one thing to say, okay, we're going to worship somewhere other than Jerusalem. Why are you making golden calves?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
How many commandments can you violate at one time?
Okay. He said to the people, you have been going up to Jerusalem long enough. This is your God, O Israel, who brought you up from the land of Egypt. He set up one in Bethel and placed the other in Dan.
Which, by the way, is what Aaron had said. Isn't this right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
Exodus 32.
In the golden calf story, like the classic don't do this story.
Right.
How could Jeroboam have known the resonance of Penuel and Bethel and not known the golden calf story?
So just so everybody knows where we are for sure, back in Exodus 32, Moses is up on Sinai receiving the Ten Commandments. The people get nervous, right? They give Aaron all their gold. Aaron puts them in the mold and makes a cast. and says, "These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you out of the land of Egypt." Jeroboam is directly quoting what Aaron said.
Yeah.
So Aaron and Jeroboam are being cast together. They both make golden calves. They both say, "These are your gods."
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a debate about what Jeroboam meant by that. I feel like the most generous interpretation is that Jeroboam was thinking of the calves as representations of Adonai, the God of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
But who has said, "Don't make any golden image"? Or
right.
any graven
right.
images.
Right, you still can't do it, but
right.
that's a more generous.
Strategically, it was smart. Theologically, not smart.
Yeah, and it really sort of, I mean, the fact that this chapter has reminded us that this, it reminded us more than once now that this is God's plan for the kingdom to split, and this is in fulfillment of that plan. And then for the plan to immediately
right.
take a nosedive.
Yeah, so now God's just got two disobedient kings instead
right.
of one.
Right.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure what to make of that.
I mean, there's a tension all the way through the biblical text between God and kings.
Yes.
All the way back in 1 Samuel chapter 8 when the people asked Samuel for a king, Samuel said, "Look, okay, you can have a king, but let me tell you all the terrible things kings are going to do. They're going to oppress you. They're going to conscript you into their army. They're going to put you to forced labor." And these are exactly the things that the kings end up doing.
Yeah.
There is a sense in the biblical text in which a king is kind of necessary. Like you were saying last time, if you don't have a king, then the things that happen in Judges 18 to 21
mm-hmm.
start happening. But there's only a certain kind of king that's appropriate. And that's a king who follows the rules of Deuteronomy 17 and thinks of the king functions as a leader of the people and not and as a position of power over the people. And I think it turns out that that's not people's orientation toward power, most of us.
Right.
God is hoping for the best in a human king, and human kings are constantly failing.
We knew this was going to be the problem with kings. And hey, look, this is the problem with kings. There's a
right.
problem with the king in the north. There's a problem with the king in the south. So I think that thinking about modern life and modern community and modern citizenship, that makes me ask myself the question, in what areas of my life or our communal life am I looking for a leader who will do something for me that perhaps I could do myself? Like sort of looking for someone who's going to come save us from ourselves. Did you know that in Burlington, Vermont, there is a store called Save the Corporations from Themselves? That's the name of the store. It's very long.
What kind of store is it?
I don't know. I don't think I went in there. Maybe I did.
That would be so much a better story if you knew anything about it.
We'll take a field trip one time and see if it's...
Yeah. I mean, it would be easier to Google, but it would be more fun to field trip.
It would be.
Someday we'll do an NLDR podcast live from Burlington,
from
Vermont.
Burlington, Vermont.
At the Save Corporations from Themselves Corporation.
You know, during Yom Kippur this year, our rabbi talked a lot about our own sort of personal taking responsibility and accountability for things going on in our community and our society. And it's very, and saying that, like, just determining who your favorite political candidate is not enough. There is not one person who's going to be able to come in and save us from what we have done to ourselves. And I guess watching the problems of all the kings that are coming up in this text makes me think about that.
Yeah, that's powerful.
What does it make you think about?
So I keep coming back to this attempt by the ruling authorities to claim God's
mm-hmm.
authority for themselves, and this kind of what Walter Brueggemann would call the royal ideology that we are God's chosen dynasty, our capital is God's chosen place, here's God in God's temple, and we're in charge of that temple. Therefore, there's no conflict between God's will and our will,
mm-hmm.
which is a rhetoric that we still hear often amongst ourselves. And God seems partly okay with that in the biblical text in an interesting kind of way. But when we start to see the kings enriching themselves and investing in their own luxurious life and exercising power for the sake of exercising power, then God starts to say, no, 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 this isn't what I had in mind. So I'm going to have to course correct here. I'm
mm-hmm.
going to take part of the kingdom from you. I'm going to, you know, God is constantly struggling with how do you deal with self-interested kings. So, you know, what God seems to have in mind is that Israel should be a covenanted community in which the people are committed to one another in some way in which everybody has enough. Even the widow, the orphan, and the stranger are taken care of. And this is what God has in mind. And the role of a king ought to be to oversee that kind of covenanted community. That's what Deuteronomy is envisioning. That's what God thinks David's going to do. That's what Hezekiah and Josiah, at least theoretically, are trying to do. So there's this tension between covenanted community in which every member has value and this hierarchical power structure in which we're talking about the girth of our loins, right? And we're just showing that we have power because we want to be powerful. And God's not having anything to do with that. God doesn't like being employed for political ends. God is looking to have political authorities that carry out God's vision of covenanted community, not the other way around. Jeroboam and Rehoboam are thinking in their own ways about political strategy. Rehoboam's strategy is you just flex your muscles, show them you're powerful, and they will fall in line. Jeroboam's strategy is you've got to build new shrines for people so that they don't turn to your political adversary. And so everybody's pursuing their own political ends instead of trying to pursue covenanted community. And that produces problems in both kingdoms.
Right. And Rehoboam is thinking about his own power. And Jeroboam, in some ways, is thinking about the power of the people and how to, you know, use the power of the people to sort of keep them together and keep him in power. But neither of them are really thinking about the power of God or the sense of God's community that they are supposed to be.
Right. Or even really in the well-being of the people. Neither one of these guys trusts that the people will follow him if he looks out for their well-being. He thinks there's got to be some kind of manipulation of their religious identity or something else to assure his own continued power. So many connections that one could make to things that are going on in the world today and things that have been going on in the world for all of the years and centuries and millennia in between.
All the time we have writings for,
It's amazing how often the Bible continues to resonate with the things that are going on in the world, like as though human beings haven't changed very much.
It's true.
So next week we are moving
Elijah, right?
Chapters next week, Amy. That's so crazy to me. We've been leaping books this last few months.
We have.
And we're just going to move six chapters into the future to 1 Kings 18, and we're going to talk about the conflict of Elijah and the prophets of Baal.
That sounds like fun.
I think it's going to be great. There's one of my favorite lines in the whole Bible is in that text, but it's never translated correctly in any English translation. Well, so we're going to correct the record next week.
I look forward to that. We've had some real quotables these past couple weeks. I look forward to seeing seeing what comes up next week.
Sadly, a couple of my quotables today had to be edited out in the post.
That's okay.
Post-recording editing process.
You got a little excited. That's okay. That's
I did.
The Bible's exciting.
All right. Amy, it's always good to talk to you.
Yes, it's a pleasure. Have a great week, everybody. We'll see you next time. Thank you for joining us for NLDR, the Narrative Lectionary Podcast for people on the go. We'll be back again here next week looking at Elijah. Until then, have a great one.